we start with some, this is just a very generic description of the basic pattern of the quantum measurement paradox, which you're familiar with, I think. We have some ensemble of systems, and typically we might think of microscopic systems like electrons or photons, say, but it doesn't have to be. And they can start from some well-defined state A and proceed along various paths. And the paths need not necessarily be in geometrical space, although it's perhaps most convenient to think of that. If we are thinking of geometrical space, then of course this is basically just a Young slits type of experiment. So they can proceed to various places, and in particular they can proceed to state E by two paths, via B and via C. And we'll assume that our experimentalist colleague knows how to, as it were, shut off either option B or option C at will. So suppose that option C is shut off. Then we know that if the system goes from A to E, it must have gone through B. And so we can measure the probability that we start from A under well-defined conditions, go through B to E. Similarly, we can shut off option B, then we measure the probability we go from A through C to E. And now, let's open both the both possibilities. If you like, open both the slits in the Young slits experiment. And then we're tempted to say that what we're measuring is the probability of going from A through either B or C to E. Now, actually, that might be a bigger question, but it seems a natural way of speaking at first sight. And of course, what we find, and what is, in some sense, the basic surprise, is that this probability that we get from A to E, when both these possibilities, both intermediate states are open, is not simply the sum of the probability of going through along the two paths separately. Even though that these two different paths may be separated widely in ordinary space or in some other way. Now, of course, quantum mechanics has a very standard description of this state of affairs. What we say is that this state of affairs is basically a consequence of the interference of amplitudes. We say the amplitude to go from A to E is the sum of the amplitudes to go via the various paths from A to E, and the probability of getting there is just the sum of the amplitude squared. And then, of course, putting this into the formula and multiplying up, we find that the probability of going from A through B or C to E is indeed the sum of these two terms, sum of the partial probabilities, but we also get the so-called interference term. And this has, of course, the typical form, which involves both amplitudes to go through B and to go through C to E. And so in some sense then, that is telling you that in some way, in a single process, both these paths are selected. And incidentally, there seems to be a special case of that, which really is rather dramatic evidence that quantum mechanics does indeed, if it describes anything, it describes individual processes and not just ensembles. And the special case is the case in which we get complete destructive interference, so that this is essentially equal in magnitude and opposite in sign to this. Now, that is one case. I mean, it's often said that quantum mechanics makes no predictions about individual systems, but only about ensembles. But that isn't strictly true. In the case where we know we've got complete destructive interference, then we can make a very specific prediction about individual systems, namely that none of them will ever arrive at the point in question. And this then seems to me to be very strong evidence that if indeed the formalism of quantum mechanics describes anything at all in the real world, it does describe something which is happening in individual processes to individual electrons and not just to the ensemble as some kind of statistical whole. Well, of course, something never happens is indeed a prediction which in some sense can never be tested with 100% certainty, yes. But one example, I mean, the point is that one example would be sufficient to refute this, at least in principle. In practice, of course, we all know about experimental errors and so forth. But anyway, what this seems to be telling us, intuitively at least, insofar as we are content to use our intuition, and no doubt we're scared to do so after 70 years of quantum mechanics, but what it's trying to tell us is that neither path, an individual system which goes through this apparatus does not definitely select path B or path C. Both possibilities are still in some sense represented in what happens. Well, that's all very fine, except that, of course, we can actually set up some kind of measuring apparatus to see which of these two a particular particle does indeed go through. And, of course, when we do that, we find out that each individual electron or whatever is definitely found to go along path B or along path C. Never through both, and if we set up the apparatus properly, always through one or the other. So that's fine so far. And in the early days of quantum mechanics, people got very worried about this, and people still. If you are an undergraduate today and you're meeting physics for the first time, you still get quite worried about it. And when we're undergraduates, we're doing physics, whatever it is, 300, the first time we meet quantum mechanics, and we get really very worried, and we go away and talk to our professors about it. And our professors look at us slightly impatient and pat us on the shoulder and send us away to read the writings of the great men like Bohr and Heisenberg on this subject. And, well, if we're conscientious, we do. And eventually, however, we become graduate students and we find that we're actually beginning to use quantum mechanics in our everyday work, and to our great surprise, it seems to work. And we go on and we become postdocs and eventually faculty members, and heaven help us, senior professors, and our hair starts to turn white and our bones start to harden. And we've been at it for about 35 years, using quantum mechanics every day in our working lives. We really can't see what's at all odd about this situation. And so, of course, when these rather irritating undergraduates come up to us and bother us about it, what do? We send them away to the library to read the writings of the great men, like Bohr and Heisenberg. Well, so they do. What would they find, people, the masters, saying? Well, at least if the masters we're talking about are the classical ones, Bohr, they are in the 20s and 30s, Bohr, Heisenberg, Rosenfeld, and so forth, what they will tell us is that, well, you have to be very careful about distinguishing between what a system is doing when it's not measured and when it is, when it is measured, when you set up a particular apparatus to look at it. Basically, so long as you don't do anything to measure the system, it will proceed along its own sweet way, obeying Schrödinger's equation and so forth. But when I make a measurement, then everything changes, and suddenly one possible outcome rather than the other is actually realized. Well, that's fine. And it made a lot of sense in the context of the atomic physics of the 20s and 30s. But of course, there was a snag about all that, and it was a snag which was pointed out rather dramatically, as you all know, by Schrödinger in a famous paper in 1935. Suppose that we think about a schematic diagram of a typical measurement. I say typical, but it's actually, in fact, I would claim it's no longer typical in the 1990s, but it was probably fairly typical in the 20s and 30s. You have some kind of oven or source of atoms, say. You might be thinking about a Stern-Gerlach experiment, to be precise. And here is some kind of pre-selection device, which is guaranteed to make sure that anything which comes out of that has a spin, any atom which comes out has a spin which is oriented in a particular direction. And we then pass the beam between the poles of a magnet, and that will then deflect the particle according to its spin component, in the sense that if we know that the spin is definitely up, it'll be deflected in this direction. If we know that the spin is definitely down, we know it'll be deflected in this direction. So, fine. Any particle which comes in with spin up is up here, and we may arrange that it, say, triggers a counter, and a bell will sound and a light will flash, or if we're lazy, we go away to lunch and leave our computer running, and the computer records what's happening there. But anyway, by this point, we've got to a sort of macroscopic event. And now, of course, Schrödinger printed this whole apparatus up by making something more interesting happening in the lower branch of the apparatus. And what he suggested is that we connect this up to a closed box, a hellish device, as he describes it, in which we have a cat and a vial of poison. And so that if indeed an atom comes down this device and triggers this counter, the gun will fire, the jar of poison will be blown open, and the cat will die. Whereas naturally, if the atom we're talking about has gone off in the other direction, the cat will stay alive and well. Now, you notice, incidentally, this is historically accurate. There is an unfortunate belief in many quarters that Schrödinger's cat is either shot or electrocuted, but not so. She is indeed poisoned, and here is the vial of poison. So what's all about this situation? Well, what Schrödinger pointed out basically was that that we know that the technical quantum mechanical description says for sure that if I have a beam of atoms which are guaranteed to be spin polarized up, then they will always and any one of them individually will go off in the upper beam, and the attack will be alive. If on the other hand they're polarized down, then each atom will go in the down beam, and the first one coming out will kill the cat. So let's just focus on this first atom, which comes out of the oven after it's switched on. Well, the problem is that quantum mechanics is a linear theory, and we know that if I set my preselection device so that the spin is sideways, and I'm talking about a spin of half, then it'll be a linear superposition of up and down. But now, this state has evolved into this one, purely according to the laws of quantum mechanics, we believe. This one has evolved into this one, and therefore, since quantum mechanics is a strictly linear theory, and this is not very negotiable, then it follows that the linear superposition will evolve into a linear superposition of cat alive plus cat dead. In other words, it'll evolve into a superposition of macroscopically distinct states. And if we attribute to the formulas of quantum mechanics the same meaning at the macroscopic level as we are used to doing at the microscopic level, then we have to say that no unique macroscopic state is actually selected at this point. And yet we all know, or at least we all believe, fortunately the animal protection societies have prevented us doing this experiment in a statistically significant way, but we all believe that if we did, then on each particular occasion, if we took the lid off the box and looked, the cat would either be alive or dead. In fact, we would not even know how to recognise this rather uncomfortable state. So that, of course, is the basic quantum measurement paradox as originally proposed by Schrödinger. So just to recap that, the conclusions of that, what if we take quantum theory seriously and apply to it the same interpretation at the macro level as we do at the micro level, then we have to conclude, apparently, that a macroscopic system must sometimes be described as not having selected a definite macroscopic state right up to the point of observation. And observation can hardly mean less than the fact, you know, the point where I actually take the lid off the box and look. And this really seems rather weird. And there have been tens of thousands of pages expended on this problem since Schrödinger first proposed it, and one could easily spend hours talking just about those. But let me just very briefly remark on two of the, as it were, extreme versions of the interpretation. One is what I call the full-blooded statistical interpretation. It's been espoused by a number of people, perhaps most prominently by Leslie Ballantyne in a rather well-known article a couple of decades ago, Reviews of Modern Physics. And what that says basically is, look, you're really taking this business far too seriously. What is the function of the formalism of quantum mechanics? It is nothing more than a recipe, a calculational recipe which is designed to give you the correct statistical predictions for ensembles of various kinds under different experimental conditions. And really, and that's true even at the macroscopic level. So, you know, there is nothing, nothing there, as it were, corresponding to the wave function or probability amplitude. It's no more real than were the calculations of the ancient Chaldeans to predict eclipses and so forth. We don't now believe there's anything behind them, but they worked, in some sense. And in the same sense, that's the function of quantum mechanics. That's, well, okay, you don't like it, that's the way life is. Nature's like that. So I think that's one point of view which is at least internally consistent. I don't like it, and I don't like it for various reasons, most of all because, after all, you know, we all invest years and years of our lives learning the detailed formulas on quantum mechanics and operating with wave functions and wave matrices or whatever, and to be told at the end of the day, well, you know, it doesn't really correspond to anything out there in the real world. It's just a calculational prescription. Seems to me a bit depressing, but one has to say it is there's no internal inconsistency in that point of view. I also feel that, like Marx's insistence, you remember Marx insisted that atoms were basically just calculational conveniences. if you'd really believed that, who would ever have thought of making a beam of calculational conveniences? You know, we'd just not have done an awful lot of useful physics that we now do. So I think if one really took this view seriously, it might have a psychologically depressing effect, in that it might stop us investigating things we might otherwise investigate.
So people who took this seriously would imagine that eventually there would be a better theory, calculating ellipses.
Well, I mean, I think you have to, to ask which individual you're talking about. But in the case of Leslie Ballantyne, for example, I think he's quite happy that as far as I can see, he thinks this is the whole truth, as it were, and it's going to stay like that. I agree with your implication that in some sense, if you did take this point of view, then you would be at least tempted to look for something deeper underlying it. But not everyone who takes that point of view does. The second point of view, which is in some sense more directly related to what I'm going to be talking about in this talk, is what I call the orthodox interpretation. And an important premise of the orthodox interpretation is that it's impossible to see the effects of quantum interference between macroscopically distinct states. And I shall abbreviate that in future as QIMDS, so please remember that's what it stands for.
Can you define the term
macroscopic? Okay, well, sure, because we're going to cut. Yes, that always comes up. Yes, but let's for the moment be very conservative and say what I mean by a macroscopically different state is one which could be recognised as such with the naked eye. That's a very conservative definition of macroscopically different.
Yes. By humans.
Yes. Yeah. I think it probably would, yes, yes. So,
yes.
Yes. If that's right. We can hardly talk about a statistical ensemble of universes, presumably. And that indeed is why I think that it was why the so-called many worlds interpretation, as far as I understand, was due to Everett, whose main interest was in quantum cosmology. So indeed, that's no accident, I think. As I say, let me be conservative, very conservative for the moment, and say that for the moment at least, I'll treat macroscopically distinct as meaning something could be recognised as such by the naked eye, as it were. Now, that is too conservative, and I'm going to loosen that definition a little later. But for the moment, let's do that. And then the argument is, essentially, that, okay, formally, quantum mechanics does indeed predict these states of superposition of a living and a dead cat, say. But there's no need to worry about this, because if you actually ask what are the experimental consequences of that of a description in those terms, you find that since you indeed can't see the effects of interference, then all experimental predictions are exactly the same as those you would have got by assuming that each cat in your ensemble was either definitely alive or definitely dead by that time, with the appropriate probabilities. Okay. That, frankly, seems to me a logical non-starter for the following reason. It confuses the meaning you give to a piece of physical formalism with the reasons you have, the evidence you have for believing that that interpretation is correct. At the microscopic level, things like the Young-Slitz experiment force us to reject the interpretation which says that each electron definitely went through one slit or the other. The evidence is the inference observed. Okay, sure, it may be true that by the time we get to the macroscopic level, we can no longer observe the effects of interference, but does that mean that we're suddenly entitled to change the interpretation of the formalism? After all, the formalism itself has not changed, at least so most of us believe, on going from the microscopic to the macroscopic level. Are we suddenly allowed, because the evidence has disappeared, to change our interpretation? Always seems to be a bit like the classical puzzle. If during a murder trial the vital piece of evidence which was undoubtedly going to convict the accused suddenly mysteriously disappears, does that mean he's suddenly become innocent? Obviously not. It doesn't. In the same way, I don't think we're entitled to change our interpretation in this way. And then, of course, I mean, I'm not for a moment pretending that these possibilities exhaust the possible interpretations, as many of you know, because there are many other possibilities, including the many worlds interpretation, which Tony mentioned, which, for the reasons mentioned, I tend not to take too seriously. But,
this statement always seems to me to be like a statement about experimental competence, right? Because
oh, yeah.
You say there's a parameter that takes you from so-called microscopic to macroscopic, and the effect of these interference then go to zero.
Yeah, right.
But if you have more and more accurate...
That's right, yeah.
Can't you, I mean, is there quantitative...
Well, I think that's precisely what I'm going to be, to some extent, addressing in the rest of the talk. But obviously, that's an obvious objection from this point of view. How do you know that experimentalists aren't going to be 100 times as clever in the future as they are today? Yeah. And we'll see, actually, they've got some of them quite clever today, in fact. Okay, but the point I want to... The reason I mentioned the orthodox interpretation at this point is that it raises the question, why is it allegedly impossible to see QIMDS, quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states? And there are two kinds of answer which tend to have been given in the literature. One of them is a very old one. It goes right back to Niels Bohr. And basically, it goes something like this. When macroscopically distinct states are involved, then the action, and here I mean the action in the technical sense of classical mechanics, the action is always large in units of h-bar. And then there's a sort of piece of folklore, which is actually not quite correct, but is still sort of one of these plausible things, which says that when S is very large compared to h-bar, then the predictions of quantum mechanics essentially go over to those of classical mechanics. As I say, that's not in fact quite true, but it's true under a great variety of circumstances. A more interesting, for our purposes, for my point of view, a more interesting reason which has been given in the literature, and it's been given rather repeatedly in the literature of the last few decades, is that the reason you can't see quantum interference between macroscopically distinct states is because these always get rapidly entangled with their environments. That is, the environment will be sensitive to whether Schrödinger's cat is alive or dead. Lots of things will change. The radiation field in the cavity won't be quite the same and a whole lot of other things. And so it'll no longer be possible to describe the poor cat by a pure state anyway. You'll have to describe it by a density matrix, and you'll find that because of this entanglement, the off-diagonal elements of the density matrix rapidly go to zero. So... And that's an argument which, I don't know who first proposed it, I suspect it was really Heisenberg in a sense, but it's certainly been emphasised by, for example, Ludwig way back in the 40s and so forth, and it's a very, very long history. It's had some very nice and elegant formal developments in the last decade or two, but basically that's the essential point. Well, okay. Let's try the effect of making an alternative postulate, namely macrorealism. And by macrorealism, I mean something rather commonsensical in a way, namely that a macroscopic system is always in a definite macroscopic state, whether or not it's actually observed. And this actually is something which Schrödinger said in almost those words way back in his 1935 paper. In some sense, therefore, this postulate assumes that microscopic potentiality goes over into macroscopic actuality. But I should emphasise, although these words look like something that Heisenberg said fairly often in his writings, I don't think I mean the same at all as Heisenberg meant by them. What Heisenberg appears to have meant, Heisenberg keeps on saying that somehow microscopic potentiality is converted into macroscopic actuality, and what he seems to have meant is that somehow the formalism of quantum mechanics by itself would make this transition for you. But he never was able to explain exactly how this happened. What I'm assuming, rather, is that quantum mechanics is not the whole truth, that there is something else that's going to come in, some new principle which comes in between the level of the atom and that of human experience.
Something else between the level of the atom and the human experience.
Yeah.
What is that something else?
Good question. Good question. Right. This, of course, is what one wants to know. And the answer is, right now, we don't know. But we do have some samples of possible theories. Okay. One possible theory along these lines, perhaps the best known one, and certainly the best developed, I think, is the so-called GRWP theory. This is Girardi, Rimini, Weber and Poole, authors. This is probably the best reference for anyone who wants to look it up. 1989. Yeah, it's basically, Girardi, Rimini, and Weber worked on this stuff for about 10 years, and Poole worked on the stuff for 10 years, and they didn't realize that they were both interested in it, and then they got together eventually and put the two theories together, and that's what came out. Basically, this theory adds something to quantum mechanics. So it adds a sort of continuous stochastic evolution to one or other. If we're in some kind of two-state system like Schrödinger's cat, then the effect of this continuous stochastic evolution is that eventually you land up in one or other of two states. And the way in which this happens is stochastic, but nevertheless, as it were, realistic. That is, at all times, you have a realistic description of your system in terms of something which looks like a quantum mechanical wave function, but is guaranteed always eventually to devolve into one state or the other. The so-called gambler's ruin process in the trade. Now, what triggers this this evolution? Well, according to GRWP, what you need is a macroscopic separation of the centre of mass of n particles. A macroscopic, well, okay, macroscopic, you see, is already getting a little less more loosely defined. In the case of GRWP, it means greater than about 10 to the minus 5 centimetres, say. But that's just their theory. Other theories could have different parameters here. The really important point, though, about the theory, and this is, let me emphasise, this is something which comes in naturally. It does not have to be put in by hand in the GRWP theory. The time scale is the order of some basic time scale, tau zero, divided by n, the total number of particles which are behaving differently in the two branches of the superposition. Now, you need this. You need this because you want to make sure that at the atomic or microscopic level, quantum mechanics continues to work. Because after all, we have pretty good evidence that it does. Very few of us doubt, and I don't think GRWP doubt, that if I could do Michelson interferometry, perhaps people already can, I don't know, if I could do Michelson interferometry on a photon coming from the most distant quasar that we can see, you know, been travelling, it's been on the road for 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 years, whatever, right, it would still show the usual interference phenomena. So we better not make tau zero too short, otherwise we're going to decohere those two branches and we will contradict the experimental results. On the other hand, it would be nice if Schrödinger's cat did indeed always turn out to be alive or dead. And more generally, if things at the level of everyday life turned out to happen or not happen. And that requires that by the time n gets to be, say, the order of 10 to the 23, we ought to have the evolution completed. We ought to have got to one state or the other. So that already puts rather severe constraints on the possible values of tau zero, and this is the choice they made, which does indeed fit these constraints. But it's a fairly narrow band, in fact, in which you can put this parameter and still get away with it.
10 to the 15
seconds
of RAM?
Sorry?
10 to the 15 of RAM?
Yeah. So, for example, if Schrödinger's cat, say, contains, I don't know, 10 to the 25 atoms, say, so that means tau zero is 10 to the minus 10 seconds, which is way, way below humanly observable the time scales. So that's okay.
What happens to time?
Sorry? For small n. Oh, well. I mean, then the superposition will persist for roughly this length of time. So, I don't know what do you want n to be. So, if n, if we're talking about a very large biomolecule, say n might be 10 to the 6, that would give you 10 to the 9 seconds, but over a few years. Okay. Yeah.
The number of particles is not terribly long time.
Yeah.
Why
good point.
Meant,
sorry. Absolutely. I mean, I think this is a possible criticism, one which has been raised, of the present version of the GRWP theory.
Or even
Sorry? In its original form, it was supposed to apply to non-relativistic particles. There had been some developments to try to make it relativistically consistent. They're quite sort of technical and complicated, so I won't try to describe them. But this insistence on n, as it were, as a relevant variable, may or may not be a good thing. It's something that you tend to get sort of tangled up in when you're doing this kind of game. But there probably are more natural ways of Yeah, they're put in by hand in such a way as to achieve two things, you know, to preserve quantum mechanics when you know it's true, and to make it untrue when you rather in some sense it is untrue.
What do you mean by untrue?
in this context? Well, in this context, it's a set of hypotheses about, in this case, about some kind of universal external noise background, which has certain statistical properties, so that you can apply it to any given physical situation. It is obviously it's so constructed that to the extent that this evolution has not occurred, it obviously just gives the same results as quantum mechanics. When evolution does occur, then the statistical predictions are exactly the same as quantum mechanics. But you have the advantage that you are allowed to believe, as it were, that the system is at all times in a definite state. So you start off with your atoms coming out of the oven, and they are indeed in, your first atom is in a linear superposition, no doubt about it. Then interacts with some kind of counter, say, and the signal starts getting amplified, 10 to the 9 electrons involved. But already we've got our tor down now to, say, 10 to the 6 seconds. By the time you produce the current pulse from the anode of your photomultiplier, it's down again. And by the time that good old Schrodinger's cat is at risk, it's been, N has grown to the extent that the times really are very short indeed. So by that time something has happened. If you ask how far, in how much technical detail has this theory been developed, the answer is actually quite substantially, in fact. I can give references if anyone's interested. It does have some difficulties. It has difficulties about conservation of energy. It has difficulties about relativistic covariance and so forth. But nevertheless, it's in some sense promising, I think, in the sense that it's an example of things which many of the founding fathers, people like Leon Rosenfeld and so forth, said quite categorically on a priori grounds could not be done.
Right.
And they've done it. Sorry?
Non-local.
And its present form, at least, is non-local, yes. And it seems that may be a rather difficult thing to get around. But, well, we'll see that quantum mechanics also has that difficulty.
So this theory, the origin, the source of this stochastic elasticity is supposed to be the rest of the universe?
It's a sort of universal non-quantum mechanical background.
What does that mean?
That means people groan because you're so used to the idea, you see, that quantum mechanics describes everything. But the hypothesis here is that there is this, if you like, this degree of freedom around which is not subject to the usual laws of quantum mechanics.
So there's something in the universe that's not subject to quantum mechanics.
That's right, yes.
Really?
Yes, yeah. Well, just like nature can actually tell its right hand from its left hand. I mean, 40 years ago, that would seem very weird indeed. I think there's a very important difference here. If all you want to do is to have a set of prescriptions which get the experimental predictions right, then of course it would do just as well. And with much less trouble, if you like. If you want to answer the question, if you like, which you may call it a question of metaphysics rather than physics, if you like, but I think that just sort of taking names doesn't matter much. If you want to answer the question, what exactly is happening in this specific case of the specific run of the experiment, then it makes a huge difference. Because quantum mechanics basically says, well, under the formalism of quantum mechanics says all possibilities are represented. The state of Schrodinger's cat being alive, the state of it being dead, are equally represented in the correct description of the universe. And somehow, when you take the lid off the box and look, one of them is suddenly pops out and is realised. Right? Now, the GRWP theory in that kind of situation would say that at all times the state is perfectly definite. It's changing in time, admittedly, in a random stochastic way, but it is definite at all times. So, metaphysics, from the point of view of metaphysics, if you like, there are plenty of people who claim that's more satisfactory. And you may not think that's worth all the trouble, but that's my opinion. Okay, anyway, the question I really want to raise in this talk is how do we know that macro-realism isn't right? Do we actually have any experimental evidence against it? Now, let's start with prejudice. And prejudice is a great thing. You know, we've all had our prejudices now for 300 years. We all believe that macroscopic bodies like this projector behave the way they do because of the behaviour of the individual molecules of which they're composed. The molecules behave in the way they do because of the atomic behaviour, the atoms because of the behaviour of the elementary particles composing them, and go on as far as you like, basically. In other words, we're all reductionists in our everyday thinking about physics, and this of course, was what I intended to illustrate by that first view graph, which I showed you. Physics is, after all, an experimental subject, and just as we should not, in retrospect, have taken for granted up to 1950, whatever it was, that nature cannot tell left from right, so I think we should equally not take for granted this reductionist hypothesis. It's been extremely useful, and by the principle of Occam's razor, if we had no good reasons against it, it would be the obvious thing to accept. But there are a lot of people, including me, who claim that we do have good reasons to reject it, namely the measurement paradox. So at least it's worth asking, do we have any evidence? Now, unfortunately, I am never going to get to the end of this talk if I don't speed up very considerably. So I was just going to show a very... Look, let me just flash this past you, basically. I said direct evidence. Now, as we'll see, in a sense, we don't have any direct evidence at what we certainly don't have any direct evidence at what I call the conservative macroscopic level, the level of everyday life. I mean, that would be spectacular. We're working towards it, but we certainly haven't got there. Okay. We have indirect evidence, and this is something I'll come to later, at more intermediate levels, levels which, by some criterion, you could reasonably define as rather macroscopic. We have brilliant evidence at a level which is somewhat above that of the individual atom, though still way, way below anything you can call macro or even, well, mesoscopic, that's a different kettle of fish. Let me just very briefly review this. I think it's one of the most beautiful experiments that's been done in quantum optics, of the many experiments in the last decade or so, and this is by the group at the ENS, Arashi's group. And basically, what they do, and I really won't better not take time going through this view graph in detail, but basically what they manage to do is, by manipulating the atom electromagnetic field interaction, they manage to put the electromagnetic field in this central cavity here into a state in which it is a linear superposition of two states in which something of the order of 10 photons are behaving differently. Now, 10 is not 10 to the 23, obviously, but it's still a very beautiful, I think, a very spectacular experiment. They don't just put it in that state. I mean, look, we all know, in principle, how to create a Schrödinger's cat state, just the way Schrödinger sits, basically. How do we tell that it's in that state? That's the nice bit. They can actually tell that it was indeed in that state, and they do it by passing a second atom through and observing the interference due to these two terms, so forth. And what's even nicer is that they can measure the rate at which the relative phases of these two states do get irreversibly scrambled by the environment, like this delta which is sitting in here. So it really is a very beautiful experiment. I would strongly recommend those of you who don't know about it to look at it. But as I say, I won't spend time on that, otherwise I'll never finish, so I'll just take this off now. So let's go back to our possible list of arguments. That's probably the most spectacular direct evidence we have right now, which is in some sense totally convincing that superposition is still is still realised at this kind of level, but it is a level only of 10 photons. So from our point of view, it's a very, very beautiful beast, but it really is only a very small Schrödinger's kitten. It's not a full-sized cat by any criterion. Sorry? Excuse me? I'm sorry, I didn't catch you. No, absolutely not. No, GRWP would certainly predict the same results as quantum mechanics under these conditions. No, you have to get a lot further than this before GRWP starts to bite.
GRWP is equal to macroscopic realism, is that?
Not equal to it, it's one way of achieving macroscopic realism.
One way, there are many ways of achieving? No.
Who knows? The question I'm trying to ask... People have put forward various theories in more or less qualitative terms. For example, Penrose has theories based on the effect of the gravitational field. They, however, have not been usually developed in great detail. GRWP is the only one which has been really, quite a lot of people have spent years on and have actually developed in fair detail, as far as I know. Okay, what about the agreement of theory and experiment for the properties of macroscopic bodies? Well, that's fine. We all know that quantum mechanics is essential, or we think it's essential, to describing, for example, the behaviour of ferromagnetic iron, the device for heat at low temperatures, and more spectacularly, the so-called macroscopic quantum phenomena, things like the Josephson effect in superconductors and liquid helium, Bose condensation in atomic gases, dot, dot, dot. However, ask yourself, if you are practicing condensed matter physicist, experimental or theoretical, ask yourself, when in my everyday work did I last have to deal with a superposition of macroscopically distinct states? And if you're not, as it were, officially in the quantum measurement business, I would claim the answer is probably never. Never do that. So, you know, one never sees the in ordinary condensed matter physics, as usually understood. One never sees the results of the effects of macro realism or molecular. One wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Okay, Bell's theorem experiments. As I said, I'm going to really have to simply, I think, skip these, otherwise I'm just never going to get to the end of what I want to say. But basically, I'll just give my conclusions that, of course, the Bell's theorem experiments are extremely beautiful and show you a lot of things which are very, very interesting about the world, not just about quantum mechanics. But they do not, in any sense, confirm or deny the hypothesis of macro-realism. If you look at it carefully, in analysing the actual experimental results in a Bell's theorem experiment, again, you never have to deal with superpositions and macroscopically distinct states. That takes a little thought, but I think you'll find that's right. So let me, you're talking about Peter Sol's work, are you?
No, I think it's better than that.
Okay, well.
But there are states of quantum mechanics which are both macroscopic and require like Bell's inequality.
Okay, that may be something I don't know about, so maybe we should talk about it later. But this is not something which has been experimentally realized.
Oh,
no. Okay. Sorry?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, I mean, this may not be something I'll be covered in what I'm going to be talking about, but we'll see. So the question is then, given that existing, or at least the traditional existing experiments don't really say anything on this point, could we nevertheless get experimental evidence on this point? Now, there's a very important principle involved here. If QIMDS does not exist or is not observable, then all the quantum predictions for the actual experimental results are going to be exactly as if the statement were always in a definite macro state. In other words, if I assume that I'm never going to be able to see the interference between the living and dead states of Schrödinger's cat, then obviously all experimental predictions which quantum mechanics makes are going to be identical to those which I would have got by assuming that each cat was alive or dead, in other words, a macro-realistic picture. So, in other words, to exclude macro-realism experimentally, one must observe the effects of QIMDS. In other words, one must set up a superposition of macroscopically distinct states, not just set it up, but set it up under conditions where quantum mechanics predicts observable interference effects. As I say, there's never any difficulty, if you believe quantum mechanics, in setting up Schrödinger's cat-like state. The difficulty is actually distinguishing them experimentally from mixtures of the appropriate components. And the question is this possible? And there's a huge history, almost literally hundreds, probably thousands of papers in the quantum measurement literature, which says no. And let's just recap, I mentioned this before, two reasons. First of all, the action in such cases is always claimed to be large compared to H-bar. So how do we get around that? Well, actually, that turns out to be not so difficult. If I can find a variable which you and I can agree is macroscopic, but nevertheless it is controlled by a microscopic energy, then there's no particular reason why this shouldn't happen. And I'll give you some examples of such cases in a moment. A much more serious difficulty is the second one, this question of entanglement by the environment. And this has been, I think it's probably fair to say that this has been the subject of quite an amount of misconception in the literature. There have been a lot of papers which basically claim that by the mere virtue of being macroscopically different, states have got to get entangled with their environments too quickly to preserve coherence. So how do we deal with that? Well, in the traditional, how do we calculate this entanglement by the environment? Traditionally in the quantum measurement literature, there have been what I call electron Sirius type arguments, which simply say, look, a macroscopic body is so complicated, it has so many degrees of freedom, the energy levels are so closely spaced, that the nearest, tiniest perturbation is going to totally scramble up the relative phases. And basically an electron on a distant star, the motion of a single electron on a distant star is going to be enough to scramble up the phases. I believe that argument is totally misleading. It fails to distinguish between the totality of degrees of freedom and energy levels and the very specific ones which are relevant to the macroscopic behaviour. And we'll see in a moment that that doesn't work. So anyway, these traditional arguments have concluded that QIMDS is impossible to observe in practice. Over the last couple of decades or so, however, people have started to do realistic calculations, not just generically, but for specific systems. And initially, to one's surprise, certainly my surprise when I first got into this business, what you find is that, in fact, the decoherence effects are much less serious than you might have imagined on generic grounds. And so that, in fact, you tend to conclude that QIMDS will be possible under favourable conditions. Now, at this point, we come to a very important point of principle. How on earth could I be sure of such a conclusion? Remember, I'm going to be talking about, in fact, things like electronic superconducting devices and so forth, or maybe complicated magnetic materials, things like that. Nasty, horrible things, sitting on the lab bench, you don't know exactly where all the atoms are sitting, you don't know where the dislocations are, the lab bench is vibrating, there's a truck rumbling past the laboratory and so forth. It's very, very different from the kinds of systems which one's accustomed to think about, say, in particle physics. We've got a nice well-defined beam coming out of an accelerator and so forth. How could I possibly know enough about such a system to convince myself of an important conclusion like this in general? The one thing I do not want to do is to start writing down a microscopic Hamiltonian and calculate the quantum behaviour. Because if I suppose I do calculate it, and I believe I calculate it reliably, and then my experimental colleagues go off and look for this behaviour in the system in question and they don't find it. The world is not going to believe that quantum mechanics has suddenly broken down. The world is going to believe that I got my Hamiltonian wrong. and people will say very justifiably, you just did not know enough about this messy system to set up a Hamiltonian. Turns out there's a way around that, or at least a partial way around it. We know that if we did have a microscopic Hamiltonian, we could derive from it both the quantum behaviour and the appropriate limit, in the appropriate limit, the classical dynamics. Now the question arises, can we go backwards? Can we start from the classical dynamics and derive the microscopic Hamiltonian? Well, answer, of course, no. But if you ask the question in a more restricted way, can I derive enough about the microscopic Hamiltonian to be able to predict the quantum behaviour? Very surprisingly, the answer in many cases is yes. So in other words, that's a highly technical issue, and it's almost certainly going to be the subject of debate in the future when it becomes, as it were, the crux of the argument. I believe that there's a very strong argument that in many cases of practical interest, you can indeed derive enough from the classical dynamics to derive the quantum behaviour, and not just vice versa. So if that's the case, we can go ahead. And as you'll see in a moment, there is some rather convincing experimental evidence in favour of this conclusion. What you find, when you go ahead with this kind of argument, what you find is that if you look back at the traditional literature on the quantum measurement problem, an awful lot of the effects which they tend to consider as killing things are actually the result of an adiabatic coupling to the environment. It turns out that doesn't in fact hurt you, or not very much. Basically, a system, let's consider an atom, say, in a two-slit arrangement. Suppose for some reason, I mean, it's not very plausible, but suppose for some reason all you could do is to ever, all you could measure directly was the position of the nucleus. Would you expect to see a young slits diffraction pattern using, say, uranium, where the nucleus is carrying along 92 electrons with it? Well, I mean, most of us would say, yes, of course, why not? And if you we probably would just say this intuitively, but if you stop to think about it, the reason is that the electrons are carried along adiabatically with the nucleus. Okay, they diverge with the nucleus, but then they converge again with it. So, it doesn't really spoil the interference effects. And that's a rather generic property. So adiabatic coupling doesn't hurt.